So thank you for coming. So what I want to do today is to describe some, like give a bird's eye overview of some of the work I've been doing. And essentially, the work I'll describe is some work that started with a paper I wrote with Dorao, Gleflock, and Lee some years ago, and that we have developing by accumulating more and more authors and collaborators. But what I would like to highlight is, you know, among this list is my three students that have collaborated in some of this work I will mention. One of the reasons I'm doing this is to kind of let the Chai students know that even though you might feel kind of lost and despair, that at some point you will get out of it. that with hard work and passion, things will be okay. So after that apple pie and motherhood words, I'll move on to the rest of the talk. So now you have to buckle your seatbelts and let's see how far we can get. So the subject of the talk is quantum field theory. So as you know, quantum field theory has a remarkable ability to be able to describe a remarkable phenomena ranging from the very short distance scales of particle physics, describing the elementary forces between all the elementary particles in the universe, to possibly quantum fields, fluctuations being the seeds for the formation of a structure in the universe. And in between, it describes a whole range of beautiful and rich phenomena in statistical mechanics and quantum many-body theory, including phase transition, superconductivity, quantum Hall fluids, and etc. So this is the part of quantum field theory that is tied to the real world, if you wish. But one remarkable thing is that quantum field theory has also provided remarkable insights into mathematics. This is especially remarkable because, unlike some other of our best theories in physics, quantum field theory has not yet been formulated in a mathematically rigorous way. Physicists were partially to blame for that. I think part of it is because we don't understand it deeply enough to tell our mathematician friends. But despite these shortcomings, this has provided a zoo of fertilization between physics and mathematics. And we will see some of that going on today. It also has been inspired and inspires certain ideas in quantum information theory that are teaching us new perspectives on how to think about quantum field theory. In particular, how to think about renormalization group flows. But unfortunately, I will not have time to talk about this subject, but I feel that this is an arena that is rapidly developing that may influence ultimately how we think about quantum field theory. And just for the level of slogans, I mean, quantum theory, given how many things it can describe, is really a poster child for the universality and unity of physics. Essentially, and the reason that this is happening is essentially that if you try to put together quantum mechanics with relativity, you're essentially left uniquely to quantum field theory. Now, something I should say is that in this talk, I will exclusively focus on relativistic quantum field theory. And I think that there are lots of interesting and basic and deep questions about non-relativistic quantum field theories akin to the ones I'm going to study that can and should be studied. But for this talk, we will just discuss, not just, we'll discuss relativistic field theories. So the first place to start is to notice that there are many, many quantum field theories. There are field theories that describe the strong interactions, and you have a field theory that describes quantum Hall fluids. And you start to wondering, can we find some organizational structure in this space of quantum field theories? The most basic question you could ask is quantum field theory one related in any way to quantum field theory two? So the way you can try to start addressing this question is by trying to define some abstract space that we know very little about, but you can try to ask, what is the space of all quantum field theories, and what is the geometric structure, geometric and topological structure that you can associate to this abstract space? So this will be one of the main themes that we will try to study in this talk. So just the same way that you start an exploration when you are in a mountain, you have to start from somewhere. So what we're going to do is we're going to start the exploration by starting with a given quantum field theory and making a deformation of that quantum field theory by deforming it by certain operators. So these OIs are Hermitian operators of your initial quantum field theory. And these lambda I's should be thought of as coordinates, or in physical languages, these will be the coupling constants of your theory. And you can try to study the deformation of the theory by studying how the theory depends on your changes with lambda. Okay. Now, geometrically, you can think of these lambda I's as some coordinates in the space of field theories, because its direction is labeled by one of these coordinates. And you can think of the Hermitian operators that you deform by as tangent vectors in the tangent space of this quantum field theory. Okay. The first difficulty that you encounter when you try to think this way is the deep and fundamental fact that coupling constants in quantum field theory, in quantum mechanics in general, are not constants at all. So these are, in particular, the main thing that happens is that these parameters depend on the energy scale that you probe. So there is no notion of saying that a given parameter is a certain number. It depends on the energy scale that you're studying it. So this, for example, in quantum chromodynamics, the value of the coupling constant depends on the scale in this peculiar way. Okay. So now the thing that you can try to do is, okay, so now that we see that the physics depends on the scale that we probe, can we try to make this a bit more quantitative? And the way this is done more quantitative is by the idea of the renormalization group and the renormalization group equations. So let me tell you some very basic things about this. For the Psi students, by the end of quantum field theory too, you will have heard all of these words, hopefully. Okay, so the renormalization group equation does something that in some sense was formalized by Wilson, but it's very intuitive, and it has been the way in which science has evolved for the last 2,000 years. You can do something without knowing everything. And this is essentially the idea of the renormalization group. Okay. Essentially, the basic idea is that the degrees of freedom that describe your physical system depend on the energy scale at which you probe that system. Okay. So the main thing that you want to write down is an equation for this space of quantum field theories, the partition function in the space of quantum field theories, and ask how physical quantities depend as you change the scale at which you resolve the system. And this is essentially the renormalization group equation. It tells you that mu is the scale at which you probe the system, and it satisfies this equation, okay? Where this introduces one of the basic objects in quantum field theory, which are the beta functions of in the space of couplings, okay? So this tells you essentially exactly what this plot was kind of highlighting, the fact that the coupling constants of the theory depend on the energy scale at which you probe it, okay? Geometrically, you can think of these beta functions as some vector fields in the space of couplings that control the behavior of the couplings as you go from the ultraviolet to the infrared. So here I just drew some picture of starting with your original quantum field theory, deforming it by a pair of couplings, and seeing where the couplings grow or get smaller as you go from, as you integrate out and you go from a given energy scale to a smaller energy scale, okay? And then you can draw some flow diagrams of this type. And you may encounter in these flows special points that are fixed points of these flow equations. And these will be important points that we will discuss extensively during these lectures. But in some very broad sense, if you are very pragmatic, I'm not the most pragmatic person in the world, but if you're very pragmatic, the task of a physicist is to solve these equations, to understand how the physics evolves from one energy scale to some other energy scale, and how to describe it. So the thing that we will be interested in is in a broad characterization of operators as how they influence the physics at very large distances. So by the definition of what the beta function is, you can classify operators essentially in three types. Operators that are called irrelevant, which have a positive beta function. These are operators whose effect on the physics at large distances is irrelevant. Then you have the relevant operators. These are operators that push you away from your original point, and you typically lose control of the dynamics of your theory. Therefore, they're very important at large distance scales. And then you have a very special class of operators that are marginal, that have a zero beta function. And these are operators, essentially, whose conjugate couplings are completely independent of the scale. like your naive intuition would be. Okay? So this is essentially the broad characterization that you can give when you study the tangent space at a point. You can label them according to this classification. So one thing that now you can try to do is do the following. You start with some quantum field theory at some energy scale, and you can ask the following generic question. What is the long distance infrared limit that you're going to get? And there are essentially two things that can happen. Both of them are interesting. The first thing that can happen is that you get a massive phase. You have a mass gap. In the old days, people would say this is a trivial theory. There is nothing interesting. There are no local degrees of freedom. But in recent times, starting from the 80s, it has been realized that you can have an interesting physics that has no local degrees of freedom, but yet still exhibits some interesting behavior if you study the theory on a non-trivial manifold, or you put the system on a manifold with a boundary. Such phases that you get in the infrared are described by a topological quantum field theory. Okay. And just an example of a topological phase with, for example, what one of the recent awards in the Nobel Prize was precisely for one of these phases, what's called the Haldane phase, which is this is a massive phase of matter that exhibits interesting phenomena when you study the theory on a manifold with a boundary. Okay? So in the 70s, people would say this is trivial. If you got the infrared, there is nothing. But if you study this theory on some non-trivial manifold, you get interesting physics. Then the other behavior you can get is that once you go to scales much longer than any other scale in the problem, by definition, you're going to get a scale invariant quantum field theory. Okay. So what is that? So this is essentially a theory that's invariant under scale transformations, where you scale all coordinates uniformly in a Lorentz invariant theory. In a non-Lorentz invariant theory, you can scale time and space in different ways. Okay. One remarkable thing about this infrared limit, which is universal, this is supposed to be a universal description of the infrared physics, is that the symmetry of the theory in the infrared is enhanced from translations and rotations that you started with. Now you have an extra generator that's the generator of dilatations, of scale transformations. Now, in physics, whenever we have a new symmetry that emerges, this is great news. Let me just give you an example. I mean, in the study of critical phenomena that people had in the 70s, you know, people were interested in studying scale invariant systems, say, near a phase transition. And people, essentially, there are six basic critical exponents that you can write down when you study the thermodynamics near a second order phase transition. And before the recognition that there is a scale symmetry, people noticed that there are essentially four equations that relate the different critical exponents. And each equation had a name, like I forget the names, Ruschbrock, whatever the names. But then later on, I think it was Widom and Kadanoff that realized that all these relations are essentially a trivial consequence of the fact that your system has a scaling symmetry. Okay. So this is another example in physics of how the emergence of an extra symmetry explains a whole wide range of phenomena that before seemed accidental. Okay. There's an analogy I could make here with also electromagnetism and how understanding the symmetries of Maxwell's equations leads to Maxwell's equations. This is a little bit similar to that story. So we see that we have a new symmetry, dilatations, that explains immediately a whole bunch of phenomena that seemed disconnected before. And what's even better, under reasonable conditions, again, these are that the theory is unitary, that the symmetries are realized by local operators, I mean, pretty reasonable things, you can further show in some cases and argue in some others, that the symmetry is not only enhanced by dilatations, but it's enhanced to the full conformal group, conformal symmetry. Okay. Also, nature is remarkable that nature has chosen this enhancement. So in experimental situations, the system is not only scale invariant, but actually enhances to conformal invariance. Okay. And this is not a small gift. It's a huge gift, because now you've gone from this symmetry to this symmetry. This is a much bigger symmetry than this one. And then you get much more constraints on the observables of these theories. And we're going to study some of these theories right now. Okay. So let me tell you just in one slide how to think about conformal field theories. So let's start first with a local quantum field theory. It can be a massive theory, but a local quantum field theory that has any local quantum field theory has a conserved local energy momentum tensor. Okay, so you have some guy that essentially measures the response of your theory to a small perturbation, and it's conserved. Okay, a conformal field theory is one in which you allow a more general coordinate transformation. Where did I have that? You essentially allow the most general coordinate transformation that preserves angles. Okay, this is essentially the definition of what the conformal transformations are. And it's an immediate consequence of the fact that the line element is just rescaled, that in a conformal field theory, the trace of the energy momentum tensor is traceless. So this is the basic, if you wish, you could, for this talk, we could use this as the defining property of a CFT. It's a theory that has an energy momentum tensor which is traceless, which is just a consequence of this symmetry. Okay. In such a CFT, operators and states are classified according to representations of the conformal symmetry. And in particular, in some sense, if you there are certain basic set of operators that transform nicely under conformal transformations, and if you know them, you know everything. Okay. These are called the primary operators, and they transform homogeneously under a scale transformation. And this, so you make this transformation, the operators transform in this way, okay? Where delta is what's called the dimension of the operator, okay? And in this theory, essentially what we're interested in is in the local correlation functions of all such operators. In some sense, if you know all the local correlation functions in a CFT, you know everything. So, by the way, you stop me anytime if I'm going too fast or too slow. This has never happened before, but it happens sometimes. So conformal field theories are directly relevant for nature. Let me give you just the two kind of famous examples. They describe critical phenomena. These are second-order or, continuous phase transitions that are driven by thermal fluctuations. Like, for example, the water-vapor transition through this line ends on a second-order phase transition. This is described by a particular quantum field theory that's conformal invariant, that's in the same universality class as the three-dimensionalizing model. I should warn the students that soon we'll have a phase transition from here to here. But I don't want to scare you too much. But this will happen any day now, literally. And then there are other types of more exotic but also interesting phase transitions that instead of being driven by thermal fluctuations, they happen at zero temperature, and they're driven by quantum fluctuations, and they're also described by some particular CFT. Okay. So apart from being kind of the bread and butter of theoretical and experimental physics, they're also foundational in other domains of inquiry. In particular, there are candidate theories that go beyond the standard model, both of particle physics and cosmology, whose basic pillar is a theory that has conformal symmetry. As we will discuss in some more detail later, they are at the heart of how string theory works. Also, in our best formulations of quantum gravity with anti-de Sitter boundary conditions. And they also play a foundational role in mathematics. So this is clearly an extremely rich subject with lots of real applications and motivates lots of fundamental ideas about physics and what goes beyond physics, the standard model.
Yeah, was there a question?
Yes.
Yeah, so I was wondering on the last slide, you said that there's always a traceless energy momentum tensor. And like for QFTs, there's always a symmetric conserved one, and there's a trick using basically GR to derive one, right?
Yes.
Is there also an algorithmic way to derive a traceless one for a CFT?
Well, so this is a fairly technical question, but the answer is yes. So to any conserved current in a quantum field theory, you can add to it what are called improvement terms. So the one way to think about improvement terms is that you can couple your field theory in flat space to some background metric. And what you can do is allow couplings to the curvature of your space-time. And you can always, if the theory is conformal, you can always choose these ambiguities, these improvement terms, such that the energy momentum tensor vanishes. The trace of the energy momentum tensor vanishes.
And there's like really an algorithmic way of finding.
Yes. Yes. By the way, I'll announce later that at the, in January there's going to be a course on CFT, and you will ask me to stop talking about this when I teach that. So yes, there is an algorithmic way of constructing a traceless energy momentum tensor by constructing an improvement transformation, which geometrically means that you couple your field theory to the curvature of your space. So if you couple it to the curvature, to the background metric through curvature, of course, this disappears when you go to the flat space limit, but it changes the energy momentum tensor. And then you can, the point is that you can prove that you can always make it traceless. It's the same way that you can make, okay, you'll regret that you asked this in a few months. Okay, any other questions? Regret or not regret, it doesn't matter. No? Okay, but to me, I mean, this is also great and fantastic that this describes real stuff, but the one point I want to really make is that conformal field theories play a foundational role in our understanding of any quantum field theory, massive or not. And essentially the basic point is that any quantum field theory can be thought of as a perturbation of a conformal field theory by some operator, okay? So you can always think of a massive quantum field theory as arising as some perturbation of one of these special theories. So understanding those theories are really kind of a first step in trying to get a handle on this massive space of all quantum field theories, yes.
So I've heard that statement before, and what I've been thinking is kind of strange is that like there's also this thing called topological quantum field theory.
Topological?
A topological quantum field theory. Can you also go from a topological quantum field theory to a CFT by adjusting some parameter?
Logical. Well, first of all, a topological field theory is a very fragile thing. So you can couple some degree of freedom to a topological quantum field theory and it stops being topological. But for example, yes, I mean, there have been very examples relevant for the study of something very esoteric called M2 brains in M-theory, where you start with some topological field theory, some Chern-Simons theory, you add some crapola to it, and you end up with a conformal field theory. So yes, you can do that. Any other questions?
Sorry, I have a question. You discussed RGPOs to the IR.
Yes.
But the way we actually construct particle physics theories is flowing from flowing to the asymptotically free theories that are defined in UV.
Yes.
No. Right. And then we flow down to lower energy from the UV. So, what's the relationship of flow from the UV to flow to the
first rule is that if you start here and you try to flow to the UV, say by an irrelevant, in general, we don't have tools to answer that question. We know how to flow to the infrared,
right,
but we don't know how to flow to the ultraviolet.
So anything could happen.
Anything could happen. You could get a non-trivial fixed point in the ultraviolet. That theory that, for example, is not asymptotically free could unify with some other theory that has an ultraviolet fixed point. I mean, this is something very hard to study. I mean, studying what you're asking is one way to think about it is that study the question of what happens when you study a CFT or field theory and you deform by an 11 operator, what happens in the UV? We don't have a general answer to study this. There are fantasies. I mean, we can say that there is an ultraviolet. I mean, not fantasies. I mean, there are concrete things that can happen logically. Like,
There are special cases like QCD, which happens to have a UV fixed point.
Yes.
And then in that case, you can claim this is a perfect quantum field theory because it's complete.
Yes.
And you don't need to add anything.
Yes.
So
unless you want to add gravity, you may say there's gravity in the world. You may have to couple to gravity at some point.
Right.
And then then you have to tell me, how do you do that?
Thanks.
Okay. The other important point I want to mention is that CFTs are kind of special points. You can think of these like in the space of quantum field theories, there are these isolated islands that give structure to the space of quantum field theories, and they really induce some kind of ordering in it. Okay. Essentially, there is the one thing that is very important and critical here is that the RG flow is irreversible. So let me try to. Here is a picture of some pattern of RG flows. Let me just tell you a couple of things about this. So The first thing to mention is that the physics of that you can get after an energy flow is extremely rich. So here is an example. You can start with some free field theory. There's nothing more boring in the world than a free field theory. But now you can imagine perturbing this by some relevant operator. At the end of a long energy flow where the theory starts becoming strongly coupled because you deform by a relevant operator, you can end up on some other CFT whose degrees of freedom are completely mysterious from this point of view. The variables are completely mysterious and so on. And by doing this sequentially, you can have this cascade phenomena where you start with some CFT and you flow down in the space of CFTs. Okay. One thing that is very important that happens in the space of CFT is that if you have gone, say, from here to here, there is no way there is nothing you can ever do to this CFT. You cannot perturb it by anything under the sun such that you can go up. So it is in this sense, this is the statement that there is a monotonicity of the RG flow. You can only flow in one direction. If CFT1 is at the end of an RG flow of CFT2, you cannot go backwards from CFT2 to CFT1. Okay? And this induces a certain ordering in the space of quantum field theories, because again, all quantum field theories can be thought of as some perturbation of a CFT. So they really provide some structure, foliation-like structure in the space of field theories. Okay, so in this classification I had of operators, there was this special guy, which is the guy that whose couplings didn't depend on the energy scale at all. Okay. So this is the space I want to start discussing. I already motivated that CFTs are foundational to our understanding of quantum field theory. So I'll start asking this question because this is one of the few places where we can say something concrete about the space of quantum field theories. Simply because only very coarse features. Sorry?
The slide is a little bit different. If for, say, pure blue,
yes.
You would not say it flows from a CFT.
I didn't say that.
So not all quantum field theories we describe. I mean, most of them we can.
So you can say you can start with
pure blue, where what?
Well, you start with a free theory, then you turn on a slight coupling. You have nothing. If you wish couple it to matter, and now add the coupling to the gluons infinitesimally. Okay, so now what I want to study here is a subspace where we'll be able to say something, even though in general we still don't know how to say many things about this space, but we will study it for the rest of the talk. So, what we will study is the space of CFTs. This means that we're going to start with some CFT, and we're going to only focus on deformations by marginal operators. So anywhere along this line, we're going to preserve conformal invariants. That's the definition of a marginal operator. It's an operator that preserves a conformal symmetry anywhere in the line. Typically, the space of conformal field theories has this funny shape. Okay. And what I want to signify with the shape is that if you start with a given description of the CFT, so you start with some, imagine you start with some Lagrangian description and you turn on some exactly marginal operator, what can happen is that as this coupling gets large and large, which means that your usual description, say using perturbation theory, breaks down, you might end up with another description of the system with completely new degrees of freedom. Okay? This is what I mean here with the alternative description of the same quantum theory. A CFT that has a parameter space can have many different descriptions that discuss are trying to represent that these are descriptions where you would have a weakly coupled Lagrangian description. Okay. Okay, not going to say anything about that. One of the tasks that we want to do now is essentially try to characterize the topological and geometrical properties of this space, and more importantly, more ambitiously, but very hard in general. What we want to do is to study the physical observables of the quantum field theory, namely the correlation functions of the primaries, as you move around in this space. Okay? Yes?
So in what situations are you guaranteed to have exactly my...
Yeah, so this is the next slide. So we only know example by example. I don't think there is a theorem about this. But precisely, what you're asking is, how do you... make sure that you have quantum marginality. How do you preserve those conditions? And in general, this is an infinite set of conditions because the beta function can, I mean, in some lay term, the beta function can have an infinite number of corrections. But for example, the first thing that you can prove, the first special thing that has to happen is that if you take your set of marginal operators, in order for this to be exactly marginal to the next order, the three-point function of marginal operators at separated points has to vanish. Okay? So this is a non-trivial condition that your CFT has to satisfy. Generically, this is not satisfied. So you can have something that's conformal at leading order, but ceases to be conformal due to quantum effects. Gauge theory is an example. QED is another example. Okay? So this I'm trying to say here. So stability typically requires the existence of extra symmetries that somehow miraculously protect you from violating an infinite set of conditions that I only wrote the first one. There's an infinite set of conditions that you have to obey. Okay? And the typical examples are current algebra, symmetry, supersymmetry. But sometimes you can also get lucky. And actually, there was a recent example of this in the literature in four dimensions, where by studying a system that has some knob, discrete knob, like large n, you could, in such an example, also construct a theory that has an exactly marginal deformation. So, and this is only was found in four dimensions quite recently. So I cannot tell you that this is an exhaustive list, because people would have said recently that only these two cases is true. But now we have this example. Yes?
Is the second,
the
large n example?
No, that's the point. No, otherwise I would tell you, no, has none of those. It's a purely Bosonic theory in four dimensions. It's not unitary, but that seems like a minor issue given the kind of question we're asking. But yes, it doesn't have supersymmetry or anything like that, no. Okay, so this space of conformal field theories, not only an interesting an interesting space to study and are going to be relevant in a second for other questions in mathematical physics, but they're also directly relevant to experiment, in fact. So a physically relevant example of a conformal field theories that have exactly marginal copings happened in the study of what is the Ashkin-Teller model, or the XY model, who won the Nobel Prize this year. Let me just tell you, this Ashkin-Teller model is essentially a model where you have two-dimensional Ising models that are coupled to each other. And what happens is that as you change the parameters in that theory, the dimensions and the coupling and the correlation functions of that CFT change. Okay. And related to the story I had here in this more general picture, as you move in the space of conformal field theories, you find cusps where you have an interesting new description. So we started with the two Ising models that were decoupled, say. You turn on some coupling and you hit another point that is better described by what's called the four-state Potts model, and so on and so forth. Actually, there might be also points in which you have even hidden supersymmetry. So as you move in this space of conformal field theories, the best description of the system might have maybe completely different. Another slogan I want to mention is that when you have a physical system, thinking it from the point of view of the long distance field theory is also very useful. Let me give you another example of this. So this year, one of the Nobel Prize was given in part for the Kosterlitz-Tauschless phase transition in two-dimensional superfluid, say. And there, essentially, what happens is that you start with a low temperature phase where you have power law correlation functions that are described by a certain conformal field theory, which is precisely this one. And then what happens is that at a certain temperature, there is a certain instability where vortices proliferate. Okay? So from this point of view, from the point of view of CFT, this is a very obvious way to explain this phenomenon. It's like you start with a certain CFT. The dimensions of all operators here depend on the value of this parameter as I move here. And the transition is driven precisely at the point where an operator in your CFT becomes relevant. This means that the theory becomes unstable and flows to a new phase of the theory, which is the kind of the disordered phase in the XY model. Another analogy that I can make, except that I won't make it because I'm running out of time.
So now you not only introduce a marginal operator, but you also change the energy. So you do two things.
The dimension of all operators depend on where you are in that point. This is a very strange thing. I mean, it's actually not strange. all physical observables depends on where you are in the space of conformal field theories. And we will see other examples of that. So now let's try to study more abstractly what is this space, what can we say about it. So the first thing to say is that this space is a Riemannian manifold. It's endowed with a canonical Riemannian metric induced by the two-point function of the exactly marginal operators. So OI and OJ and exactly marginal operators, their two-point function define in a unitary theory a Riemannian metric, okay? Which are non-trivial functions of these couplings, okay? And you want to understand certain geometrical and topological properties of this space. Okay. So let's study one context in which this problem of understanding the space of conformal field theories has was asked before in the context of string theory. Okay. So in two slides, I will try to say something about string theory. I mean, I cannot make justice to this subject in a few slides, but let me try you to motivate some of the key ideas and beautiful ideas that underlie it and how it relates to our discussion so far, okay? So the first beautiful observation I want to make is that the vacua of string theory are described by two-dimensional quantum field theories that are conformal invariant. So a string theory in the usual description is described by a certain two-dimensional quantum field theory that lives on the world sheet of a string. And demanding that the theory on the string world sheet is conformal invariant is what gives rise to all the space-time physics, okay? So one of the very beautiful things that happens in string theory is that by quantizing this simple two-dimensional quantum field theory, you recover some of the most beautiful equations in physics. So you recover Einstein's equations, you recover Young-Mills equations, you recover the Dirac equation, et cetera, okay? And the principle that's behind all these equations is two-dimensional conformal invariance, okay? Now, how do we write down the theory on the world sheet of a string more concretely? So it's going to be a two-dimensional quantum field theory. So it's going to be a local integral over the world sheet of the string of a two-dimensional quantum field theory that describes maps from your world sheet to some manifold X. So these phis, you could think of it as some coordinates in some space-time. And G alpha beta is a metric on space-time. Such a theory is called a nonlinear sigma model. By the way, nonlinear sigma models are not only foundational to the description of string theory, but they also are also foundational in condensed matter physics. For example, this Haldane phase can be thought of as an O3 nonlinear sigma model with some theta angle. So the study of this of nonlinear sigma models is not only important in string theory, it's important in condensed matter physics and in topological phases. Okay. Now, one of the things that makes things very hard in string theory is that, so any question in space-time has a reflection on the world sheet. So one of the puzzling things about that makes this hard is that the path integral that would compute observables on the string world sheet is subject to some important non-perturbative corrections, which are called world sheet instantons. So these are some holomorphic maps from the world sheet to the space-time. Okay. So these are topologically non-trivial saddle points of the two-dimensional quantum field theory path integral, just like you have when you study instantons in gauge theories or in quantum mechanics. Okay, and one of the major difficulties is how do you? Okay, so this is beautiful. You mapped some problem in space-time to some problem in the world sheet, but now you have to solve the world sheet theory. How do you do that? One of the big obstacles is to understand how to take into account these non-trivial saddle points. As I said, there is a deep interplay between space-time and world sheet physics. And now let me take a very particular example where we'll be able to say something very concrete and solve a problem that was left behind from the 80s and the 90s. So consider vacua of string theory down to, this is supposed to be Minkowski space, where we approximately live. And let me make just some connections about between entities in space-time and entities on the world sheet. So if you study, you want to know what is your spectrum of massless scalar fields in four dimensions, these are in one-to-one correspondence with precisely the guys I was talking about before. So massless fields are in one-to-one correspondence with marginal operators in the two-dimensional conformal field theory. So to every space-time field phi I propagating in Minkowski space, I associate exactly marginal operator in the two-dimensional conformal field theory. So that's a statement about the spectrum. How about interactions? One of the nice things about string theory is that all properties of a space-time, including space-time interactions, are encoded into correlation functions of the two-dimensional conformal field theory. So in particular, if you want to write down the action for these massless scalar fields, in general, it will look something like that, in the kinetic term. It will look like a four-dimensional space-time action, but the metric in the space of fields can be non-trivial. Okay. Now, how is this computed and how it relates to two-dimensional conformal field theory? Well, precisely the guy that appears in the four-dimensional action is the gadget that we introduced earlier, the Zamolodchikov of metric. Okay. So if you want to write down the space-time action of your four-dimensional quantum field theory that you get by studying string theory on this geometry, it will require you knowing exactly the Zamolodchikov metric on the space of two-dimensional conformal field theories. Okay. So by studying space-time physics, you're forced into studying this problem of the Zamolodchikov metric in the space of conformal field theories. Oh, yes.
So can you go back one slide? How is it that this integral overall space or space-time of these fields is correspond to the value of this correlator between given points?
No, the only thing that really matters, so this gamma ij, all that matters here is the gamma ij. How do you compute gamma ij as a function of the couplings? Maybe I didn't understand your question.
So how is it that you have this thing over here is some integral over all space, right?
No, sorry. But the only thing that matters here is that inside this integral, there is this gadget. But there is this gadget, right? The only thing that we don't know about this Lagrangian is what is the metric in the space of fields. And what I'm saying is that the metric in the space of fields that appears in the Lagrangian of the four-dimensional field theory is computed by this separated two-point function of the CFT.
But I think his question is normally a metric would be a function of
it is
phi's.
It is phi's. It is a function of phi's. And this is a function of lambda.
Functions of x.
Sorry?
So the right-hand side, you have gamma ij as a function of phi.
Yes.
But phi is constant in that formula. It's not x dependent.
No, you can promote it. We'll do it in a second. You can promote it to the space-time.
I see. So you think about the CFT in a background with a phi
yes.
x.
Yes. You will see this will play a crucial role in the studies. So one class of physically appealing and mathematically interesting vacua is when you go down on a space or you go down on Minkowski space on a manifold that is called the Calabi-Yau manifold. This has led to lots and lots of beautiful physical phenomena and mathematics also. A Calabi-Yau manifold just between friends is essentially the statement that if you study an n-dimensional manifold, it typically has SON holonomy. It means that if you parallel transport a vector, it will come back up to an SON rotation. A Calabi-Yau manifold has the property that the holonomy is reduced. So it's a particular subgroup of SON. Okay. That's, I'm sure Kevin could give you a lecture about how to say it more properly, but that's, for a simple man like me, that's enough. Now, one of the important things that happens when you study such vacuum of string theory is that the two-dimensional conformal field theory that describes such compactifications acquires an extra symmetry. It has not only conformal symmetry, it has superconformal symmetry, okay? Just like, exactly like one of those points in the Ashkin-Teller model also had superconformal symmetry, okay? Then when you have extra symmetry, you can then prove statements about, it leads to special properties that you want to exploit. So one thing that you can prove that's a direct consequence of having enhanced symmetry is that the space of conformal field theories is a complex scalar manifold. It means that the Zamolodchikov metric essentially is obtained from a scalar potential. Okay, so if you have a function, and the metric is derived just by taking derivatives of that function. Okay. And this function plays a crucial role in studying the effective field theory in space-time that you get in such vacua. Determining such a gadget determines not only the metric, the kinetic terms in your four-dimensional effective field theory, but it also describes what are called Yukawa couplings and other terms that are of, if you try to use this as a phenomenological approach to particle physics, these are things that you would want to compute, like Yukawa couplings, are embedded inside this scalar potential. And again, the major obstacle is that, okay, we can compute this pre-reliable in the point particle approximation, where we neglect precisely the worst instanton corrections. But the question is, can you do better? Can you really determine this by solving essentially a two-dimensional quantum field theory? This gadget K, as I just mentioned, receives an infinite series of world-shifting instanton corrections. of this type. So essentially, this is what is, as I said before, an instanton is some non-trivial saddle point of the path integral that carries some topological charge, which essentially is measured by this beta. And it can be written in this form. Essentially, this exponential here is just the action of the instanton, like just what you do in quantum mechanics instantons. It has an action. And then you have a very nasty thing that you have to compute, which is the integral around the non-trivial saddle point and path integrate over all fluctuations. Okay. One very remarkable thing that was shown, I guess, by mathematicians, is that this gadget that appears in this formula, n beta, that you get by doing these horrendous things I just said, like integrating over the modular space of instantons, of worldsheet instantons, that this gadget that appears in this computation is an interesting topological invariant. It's called a Gromov-Witten invariant. It is an integer. Okay, proving this is non-trivial, but it's a fact. And it's interesting that, motivated by a physics question of trying to construct some model of particle physics, you stumble into some objects that are of interest to mathematicians, these topological invariants. Now, the problem is that in general, we don't know how to solve, how to compute such quantities. Okay, and in fact, there were a whole field that I don't have time to do justice to, which is called mirror symmetry, which arose as an attempt to exactly solve this problem of how to determine this gadget here. Okay. And at the level of slogans, what this huge amount of effort went into mapping the problem of computing instantons in your original Calabi-Yau X to a classical geometry computation on some other Calabi-Yau Y, which is called the mirror Calabi-Yau. Okay. And absolutely great amounts of work went into this. And for example, Concevich in part got his Fields Medal for work for mirror symmetry. Okay, but one of the, I mean, as a simple person like I am, I mean, one of the basic problems that you have when you study this problem is that for a given Calabi-Yau, you in general do not know how to construct the mirror manifold. Okay, so this technique is a problem. So there was a lot of progress in computing these numbers for Calabi-Yaus for which you could compute the mirror manifold. But what about for those that we do not know the mirror manifold, which I think is the generic case? The question is then, for those cases, how do we determine K? Okay. So now I'm going to tell you how this problem, we solve this problem by using physics ideas, I think simple and beautiful physics ideas, I think. OK, so the idea, let me just try to give you a recipe of how we did that. The first thing that we did is that we were studying a two-dimensional conformal field theory in flat space. The first thing that we will do is to place the conformal field theory on a two-sphere. This should be okay because we're in a conformal field theory, and you can essentially modulo some subtleties. You can conformally map a CFT in flat space to any conformally flat manifold like the two-sphere, okay? By just doing an stereographic projection, okay? The other thing that we will do is that we will promote the coupling constants of the CFT to background fields. Okay, so now the coupling constants of your CFT are going to be functions on space-time. Now, doing these two things separately and at the same time give rise to a conformal anomaly. Okay, so now I have to tell you quickly what this means. So an anomaly is a quantum mechanical violation of a classical symmetry. So from another theorem, we know that for any classical symmetry, there is a conserved current. An anomaly is essentially a violation of that symmetry due to quantum effects, which cannot be removed by any choice, essentially. Okay. This gives rise to violations of the naive invariances of the theory by a non-trivial anomaly. And anomalies play an absolutely fundamental role in quantum field theory. First of all, they restrict the space of consistent unitary quantum field theories. So if the anomaly is in a symmetry that is a gauge redundancy. If you have an anomaly for that symmetry, then the theory is inconsistent. But if the anomaly is in a global symmetry, it's fine. There is no fundamental problem with it. And in fact, the fact that there are anomalies for global symmetries in physics is very important because they explain important physical phenomena in nature, like the decay of the pion into two photons, or the fact that if you look at the quantum Hall fluid, there is a chiral current in the boundary. Okay, Also, anomalies play an important non-perturbative role in quantum field theory because the idea of anomaly matching, that if you have an energy flow from the ultraviolet to the infrared, even though the theory in the infrared is completely different than the ultraviolet, the anomalies in the ultraviolet and the infrared have to match. So this gives a very strong constraint on what dynamics can appear in the deep infrared of an energy flow. So then what you can do, what we did essentially, is to write down what the anomaly is for once you promote the theory to curved background, and once you promote your coupling constants to background fields. Essentially, you have two contributions to the anomaly, one that comes from the coupling to the curvature, and one from the fact that the coupling constants were promoted to background fields. Okay? If you took my CFT course, I would, in one lecture, we would derive this formula by just doing a simple flat space analysis, how these formulas arise as a violation of conformal symmetry. So in the classical theory, this guy would be zero. The variation of under a wild transformation of the log of the partition function would vanish. Due to the anomaly, it's no longer zero, and it's this gadget. And there are essentially two things that I want to highlight here. What appears in the anomaly is C, the central charge of the CFT, which I will not tell you much about because I don't have time, but it's a very coarse feature of the CFT. It's one of these, it's a parameter that appears in many physical quantities in the CFT, but it's in a sense, it's very coarse. This parameter does not depend at all on where you are in the space of conformal field theories. And then also the metric appears. Exactly the gadget that we care about appears in the anomaly, okay? Then before doing any work, you can, by essentially physical considerations, you can prove that a certain topological features of the space of conformal field theories in Clavijaus, which imply in particular, you can prove that this space in particular has to be non-compact. Okay, so now the thing that you can prove essentially by, you have this equation, now you can try to integrate it. You have, you know, that the variation of something equals this. Now you can try to integrate the equation just like Polyakov integrated the conformal anomaly in two dimensions. What you find is that the partition function, once you restrict it to the two-sphere, computes up to this factor that's not so interesting, the exponential of minus the Keller potential. This is precisely the guy that we were trying to get a handle on. This K is the quantity that determines the metric in the space of quantum field theories. So what's remarkable is that we have identified some observable in an auxiliary space, namely a two-sphere, who computes precisely the gadget that we cared about in our flat space, which is this Keller potential, okay? So essentially what we've given is we have given a physical meaning to the partition function of the two-sphere for this class of conformal field theories, okay? But this is all very nice, so we have given a nice geometrical interpretation of what the partition function of the two-sphere is, but I haven't told you how to compute this partition function. So that's what I want to describe next. So, and the idea is very simple and physical. So what we want to do is compute the partition function of a certain CFT that describes one of these, say, Calabria compactifications, even though it can describe other things. And what we want to do is to think of this CFT as arising as the endpoint of a renormalization group flow of a gauge theory in the ultraviolet. So you start with a two-dimensional gauge theory in two dimensions, which is super renormalizable, which means that it's weakly coupled, extremely weakly coupled at very high energies. And we engineer it in such a way that as you flow to the infrared, you get the conformal field theory that you care about, okay? And we denote the partition function of the gauge theory in the ultraviolet by ZS2UV, okay? In order for this to be useful, what we had to prove is that the partition function of this ultraviolet gauge theory is a renormalization group invariant observable. What this means is that the partition function of this gadget does not depend at all on the energy scale. So this arrow goes from high energies to low energies. And then we use the fact that the partition function of this theory is independent of the energy scale to conclude that, therefore, that the partition function in the extreme UV is the same as the partition function in the extreme infrared. And therefore, that the partition function that we cared about, which is that of the infrared CFT, is exactly the same as the partition function of the ultraviolet gauge theory. Okay, but now we're in the ultraviolet. As I said, two-dimensional gauge theories are super renormalizable in the ultraviolet. If I go to the extreme high energy limit, the Saddle-Prandtl approximation becomes exact. Okay, so we can just write down and solve the path integral of the four-dimensional quantum field theory. and write, and by this connection, write down the partition function and therefore the Keller potential as an exact function of the coupling constants spanning the conformal manifold. Okay. So I'll just flash the formula to tell you that it's exactly very simple at the end of the day. This formula essentially is an exact analytic formula that computes the partition function of an infrared CFT in terms of the data of the ultraviolet gauge theory. And as you see, it's just some simple contour integral with gamma functions. And the details that I don't have time to go through here encode the information about the two-dimensional gauge theory that you constructed that flows to the CFT. By doing just residue computations, this determines the exact metric in the space of conformal field theories. It does this by a completely physics-based approach using the remodulation group, which just mapped the problem, a very hard problem of a nonlinear sigma model with non-perturbative corrections to essentially a free field theory computation. Not free field theory is an exaggeration. It's a semi-classical calculation in an ultraviolet gauge theory in two dimensions. So, and that you can do. I mean, by the end of quantum field theory 2, all of you can do this computation, I guarantee you. It's really very simple. It's just doing one loop computations, fluctuations of a two-dimensional gauge theory around a background magnetic field, essentially, roughly speaking. This V is the magnetic field that you have to sum over on the two-sphere when you study gauge theories on the two-sphere. What was fun is to show that in the cases where you knew the mirror manifolds, X and Y, remember that I said that in the old approach, people computed Gromov-Witten invariants by mapping the problem from one Calabi-Yau X to a mirror Calabi-Yau Y. We were able to establish, indeed, that the partition functions were the same. But the key distinguishing fact of this approach is that this approach does not rely at all on mirror symmetry. We obtained the Keller potential of the CFT, not by going through some fancy Calabi-Yau somewhere else. We just constructed an object in the ultraviolet and computed it. So this kind of leaves the basic problem that existed in the literature before of having to go through these mirror manifolds. Okay? And concretely, studying these integrals has led to new topological invariants of the ones I described before that appear, that are defined by this expansion of the Keller potential. Okay? And then you can have data. I mean, this is theoretical data, but look, you can do experiments and go to the mathematicians and tell them, can you get these numbers? And the answer is yes. Okay, so this is one application that I wanted to mention of the space of quantum field theories in two dimensions that is directly relevant to string theory and also to mathematical physics. In the, how many, 5 minutes? I started a bit late, I think, 5 minutes. I'll tell you, this is some work that I did more recently that tries to solve the following problem. So here I'll have to necessarily be brief. So let me just motivate by saying that, one clear question is, can we use any of these ideas to learn something about four-dimensional quantum field theories? Okay. The basic thing that you find is that, immediately realizes that solving a four-dimensional quantum field theory is currently out of reach. I think that's a fair statement. And in fact, not only that, is that up to now, until recently, no known exact correlation functions of local operators in any quantum field theory were known. Okay, so just choose any correlation function in a four-dimensional quantum field theory which is interacting, and you don't know how to write the formula for that. Okay, and what I want to describe very briefly is how this, for a particular class of correlation functions in a class of four-dimensional field theories, this problem was solved. Okay, and the class of theories where this problem was solved is by conformal field theories again that had extra symmetries. Apart from just having the energy momentum tensor, they had extra conserved currents that generate what's called n equals to supersymmetry in four dimensions. Okay. So of course, I cannot solve QCD. So what I'm doing is I'm taking the simplest possible theory where this problem can be solved completely. Okay. If I could do QCD, I would do QCD, but I cannot. So I'm doing this toy model of n equals to superconformal field theories. Okay. Among these theories includes the well-studied and famous n equals 4 super Young-Mills theory, but also other perhaps more interesting theories like SUN super QCD, which has 2n flavors of quarks. Okay, so the basic problem that we want to study is study a special class of correlation functions which we call extremal correlators. So this is a correlation function of a whole bunch of a string of operators that are annihilated by certain, by half of the fermionic symmetries, and another operator that's annihilated by the other half of the symmetries, okay? These correlation functions, in a sense, are the simplest correlation functions you can have that you can have in this class of quantum field theories. These correlation functions, if you could try to make an analogy to scattering amplitudes, are to scattering amplitudes where the MHB amplitudes are, where you have operators all of the same type and one of the other type, okay? Now, these operators have a special property that they generate a ring. So if you take the operator product expansion of these operators, you get a non-singular OPE, and you get another operator there, okay? By virtue of this property, essentially all these correlation functions can be reduced to the correlation function of a two-point function of an operator of this type and the conjugate operator. And all the data in the CFTs is solved once you know this generalized metric in this ring, okay? One thing that I want to emphasize is that since you're inserting correlators that are annihilated by one half of the Qs and by a complementary half of the Qs, these correlation functions do not preserve any of the Poincaré supersymmetries that you have in usual supersymmetry. And essentially, so now you can give a geometric interpretation of what this metric is. The simplest case that you can study is when these operators have dimension 2, and then this metric is again just as a Malojkov metric in the space of four-dimensional n equals two conformal field theories. These parameters that appear here in the metric that parameterize exactly marginal deformations for this gauge essentially is just the, so G squared is the Young-Mills coupling constant of the theories that I described before, and this tau is some a holomorphic combination that combines the Young-Mills coupling constant with the topological theta angle. But the main problem that we have here is that these correlation functions are afflicted with an infinite series of both perturbative and non-perturbative corrections due to Young-Mills instantons. So the question is, can we use any of the insights that we had in our two-dimensional problem to solve this problem in four dimensions? The answer is yes, but I don't know how much time I have to give you. How much time do you give me? Zero? Okay, so let me just tell you that essentially this problem can be solved. I'll ignore you, essentially. I was here before you, so I can do it, all right? Yeah. essentially, this problem can be solved, again, by a combination of anomalies and essentially by mapping the problem to the Sphore sphere and solving the problem in the Sphore sphere and essentially finding how there is a relation between the problem that we're trying to compute, which is the correlation functions of local operators on R4, can be mapped to a certain problem that we can solve exactly on the Sphore sphere. And just to show you that this is not just blah, blah, blah. Well, so there's a lot of interesting things behind it. I mean, these correlation functions we showed that are acted on by a system of integral differential equations of the TODA type, which is interesting, but yet do not solve the problem. You have to do an extra computation to really solve the problem. So let me just tell you very quickly what some of the things that you can do with this. So what we found that I didn't really have time to describe is that we have a now concrete algorithm to compute extremal correlators in these four-dimensional n equals two CFTs. What we do is express the observables in R4 in terms of a certain partition function on some auxiliary space. This is also already a theme that we use in two dimensions that was very useful. And this mechanism gives you a first instance, as far as I know, of a non-perturbative solution of a quantum field theory correlation functions in above two dimensions at finite n. It has a whole bunch of interesting connections from more mathematical to more physical. And I'll just finish by mentioning an interesting connection to the large order behavior in perturbation theory. So in both quantum mechanics and quantum field theory, we have this issue that perturbation theory is an asymptotic series, and you might want to study what is the behavior of the asymptotic behavior of that perturbation theory series. So since it's not very common that you have an exact computation that you can study to arbitrary high order in perturbation theory by pre-elementary methods, one of the things that we did is to study the Borel summability properties and the convergence of the Padé approximation in these quantum field theories. In particular, there was an old conjecture from the 80s about the This came from very practical considerations, namely, in QCD, people have to work very hard to go from n loops to n plus one loops. So Carliner with other people were getting anxious, so they devised some kind of conjecture of whether they could guess what the next order result would be, given on the, what they knew before. And they proposed a conjecture, which of course they had no way of checking, of how quickly the Padé approximation to the perturbative series deviates from the exact value. Okay? And what we've shown for one of the theories that we studied concretely is we found that this conjecture is absolutely correct. I mean, that there is an exponential convergence to the Padé approximation to the perturbative series that was conjectured in the context of QCD. Of course, we have not done QCD. We have done this super QCD theory. But in this context where we have explicit tools to check, we have seen that this conjecture is correct. This, I just mentioned this as a one kind of physical application of these computations that we did. So we're at the conclusion. So I just want to say that the space of quantum field theories is a vast and uncharted territory. We've seen that anomalies, spheres, and energy flows have given us lots of insights into the geometry and topology of the space of CFTs. And fortunately, these studies have led us to new light, have shed new light on old problems in both quantum field theory and mathematics. So before I close, I'll mention that for an introduction, much more gentle, of these topics, including CFTs and anomalies, I'll see you in quantum field theory 3 course later this year. Thank you.
Thanks, Jaume. So it's time for questions, and we have this tradition that we start asking students if they have any questions. Science students?
Yes.
I'm not science.
Science students? You had your chance.
Yeah. So the claim is you say you can calculate the uncorrelator and two like deep e larger than the two CFT. So it doesn't care, you don't like you can do it even in half dimension.
No, so this was something very specific like four dimensional CFTs.
Oh, just gave an example. Yeah.
The only example I know of a theory above two dimensions where you can compute any correlator exactly.
Any correlator.
Or the free field theory which doesn't count. Because
okay. Did you show a formula for the 4.1?
No.
Do you have it?
No. I will have it, but I can show it to you. Well, one thing I can show you is this. I mean, so essentially, what I said is that for the 4-point function, for this special class of extremal correlators, can be reduced to the 2-point function of operators in this ring. So essentially, the formula boils down to something like this. What we were able to prove. I mean, there's some story here about anomalies that I didn't have time to explain, but essentially this problem can be written in terms of the ratio of determinants of a certain partition function on the four sphere. So if we know how to compute this, which we know, then you can extract the correlation function.
This is coupling behind the partition function?
Absolutely, absolutely. No, it depends on everything that you can imagine. Yes. Okay, except n equals 4. N equals 4 has a special property. These correlators are saturated by the free field value. But for n equals 2 theories, they have an infinite number of perturbative and non-perturbative correlations.
Is it related to those that Pascal is computing?
No, it's even much older than that. It's just in n equals 4 are the things that you know, the chiral primary operators. It's just that you can prove that they have no perturbative and no non-perturbative corrections. Yes.
One C-bar and the other one
yes. Yes. But here you can always write any such object as some ratio of
generalization of that when it goes.
Yes, but now there is teeth here. I mean, there is, yes. Yes. Yes.
Are you putting the theory on the four sphere in such a way that there's some supersymmetry preserved, like Peston?
Yes.
So this is Peston's function?
So this would be Peston's partition function on the four sphere. If you restricted your attention to studying the dimension to, okay, so if you restricted your attention to O1, imagine you wanted to compute all the other correlators, O(n) for n bigger than 1. Then what we had to do is extend Peston's computation. So this ZS4 was not Peston's, it's something that we worked out with Nafis, which is probably hiding, and Zohar, and a whole bunch of people. So Peston would give you the Zamolodchikov metric. To get all the correlators, you have to work hard and kind of extend Peston's computation in the presence of arbitrary elements in the chiral ring.
So can you learn then about What do you learn now from the bootstrap? Is this a way of computing being part of the spectrum, probably, right?
But the bootstrap people... I guess you're one of them? No. You know probably better than me. But they can use this as an input when they study the crossing equations of the bootstrap in the case where you have a conformal manifold. Because I can tell you the correlation functions at this point are blah. And I think that there's Rastelli students that are looking into that.
So in 2D, you can solve those correlation functions because you have like your Sora algebra and things like that. Do you have a similar algebra?
No. Well, first of all, in two dimensions, you can only solve those correlators when you have Virasoro algebra for the minimal models. Oh. For the CFTs, you definitely cannot solve them using the Virasoro algebra. In fact, the way you solve it is by mapping this to a gauge theory problem. But Virasoro doesn't, except for minimal models, doesn't determine the correlators at all. I saw some other hand.
On the previous slide, you had this comment about how that you were checking how fast the Bede approximants converged.
Yeah.
So what was there? Why did they think that conjecture was true back then? Was it just based on the first two orders extrapolating, or did they have some arguments about why?
I think essentially they knew the answer for two loops and three loops. They guessed just based on that. And actually, I think the point is that when 5 years later as the next loop came, it agreed already quite well with this conjecture. So they just had some deep intuition that this was converging extremely fast. But of course, I mean, you know, it really converges when you go to 70 orders in perturbation theory. It doesn't, for here, you know, there is some wiggle here. So this is a, I mean, they didn't really have a very sharp stem, but in the stem.
That's part of what I was going to ask. Did they just predict it was exponential, or did they actually predict the coefficient next time?
No, they didn't predict the coefficient. But here, we can calculate the coefficient. It's 0.7.
Let's thank John again.